This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, during this edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley will have information and advice on a boom in 401k rollovers. More retirees than ever are shifting their funds from 401k style plans to individual retirement accounts. Is this always a good idea? Plus, advice on how to fly high without paying high prices and answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And today we are honored to have Kevin in our studios in Madison. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So it's good to have you here in Madison. Got some stuff happening.
A little business to do. That's right. Wasn't that a nice summer we just had? That was good. Those 4 days were phenomenal. I really made the most of it.
Yeah. Thank you, not polar vortex. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a new study that talks about how much it can cost for auto insurance and how your credit score can be affected by that, Kevin?
That's right. It was a new study from the website WalletHub, wallethub.com. What they did is they created two profiles that were exactly the same, except one potential insurance purchaser had excellent credit history and the other one had no credit history. And they wanted to figure out which companies made the biggest distinction between the person with good credit and the person with no credit. How much more money was paid by the person with no credit, and which companies were the most transparent in the fact that they were using this criteria as a way to charge their potential customers.
And what did they find out?
It can be a very big difference. Nationwide, on average, the driver with no credit history paid 65% more in premiums than the driver with excellent credit history.
Ouch.
And in Wisconsin, it was 80% more. Our neighbors to the west, south, and southeast, Minnesota, Illinois, and Iowa, drivers with poor credit or no credit paid 86%, 65%, and 50% more. And the average cost of car insurance in the country is about $1,000 per year. So if you're paying, say, 80% more, you're looking at, depending on the state in question, $600 to $2,000 more per year for auto insurance just because of your credit score.
Well, what company stood out in the study?
Depending on the metric, the biggest difference between the driver with excellent credit and no credit history, there was 116% difference for Allstate. The smallest difference was State Farm with 45%. Progressive was deemed to be the most transparent, meaning that they made it most clear to applicants that we are going to use your credit score. And Liberty Mutual was the company that was said to be the least transparent in terms of telling people how they were going to incorporate this into their premium cost.
Your thoughts, Kevin? Is it right to use credit scores to charge more money for auto insurance?
Well, it depends on your situation. Studies have shown, and there's a reason for this, is that people with poor credit generally are more likely to make a claim for it on their auto insurance, and that's when insurance companies try to do right pricing. I mean, they try to make the risk pricing exactly appropriate for this person's risk. And so if they find that, they're going to use it. And it's subject to state law. There are only three states right now that don't allow companies to use credit scores as part of their premium pricing: California, Massachusetts, and Hawaii. But it can be good news for you, because if you are a good driver and you have a good credit score, you're going to end up paying less for your insurance, because the people with poor credit are going to pay more.
All right. So what's our takeaway from this study?
Well, the credit score is just one factor determining what you pay for auto insurance. But you should keep it up anyway, in part because that's also going to affect not only your ability to get a loan and what you pay, but also can affect your homeowner's insurance premiums as well, and in many cases, your employment prospects. And note, as part of the study, they did not use a person with bad credit. They used a person with no credit history. So it could be even worse if you have a very low credit score. You can check your score and see how you fare by going to myfico.com and paying a small fee. Or there's an ad-supported site, which is pretty good. It's called creditkarma.com. That's free. And you also can get a lot of information on how to boost your score and save some money on interest at creditkarma.com. And you can use this study at wallethub.com as a way to shop around for auto insurance. If you have very good credit and you want to try to save some money, you might want to go to a company that gives you more credit for having a good credit score. And if it's not so good, you might want to look at a company that doesn't make such a big discrepancy between what they charge good credit scores and bad credit scores.
Got it. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, we have an open line for you. 1-800-642-1234. Do you have a money matter on your mind today? A personal finance dilemma? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. A listener named Dave says, is there an advantage to rebalancing a 401k account when the market is up or down? I don't know what that means, but Kevin does. Hi, Kevin.
That's why I'm here. Thank you very much, Joy. Especially since a lot of people are just getting their June 30th statements for their 401ks if they still get them on paper. And on the surface and underneath, it can be a very good idea to take a look at rebalancing. Rebalancing is where you hopefully have complementary investments in your portfolio, meaning that while one is zigging, the other is zagging. While one is going up, the other is going down, or maybe not going up as much. And rebalancing involves moving the portfolio back to its original allocation, or maybe one that's more suitable based on where you're at in life or what's changed in the world, the financial world. So let's say if you're 50% stocks and 50% bonds, and because the stock market has outperformed the bond market recently, you're now 60-40, meaning you look at your portfolio and 60% of it is now in stocks and only 40% of it is in bonds. Rebalancing means you sell some of the money that's in the stock account and put it into bonds, and it allows you to get back to that original 50-50 allocation.
I get it now. So what's the initial reason this is a good idea?
If you really do have complementary investments, and meaning ones that offset each other, eventually things that go up go down, and eventually things that go down do start to come up. And so it's the more academic phrase is called regression to the mean. And if that actually happens with your investments, by selling things that have gone up and moving them into things that have gone down, you've sold high and you've bought low, which that, by the way, is our very secret On Your Money investment strategy. Buy low, sell high. Wait, no. Yes, buy low, sell high. I keep getting that wrong. The lawyers always tell me.
Well, that's what I try to do. But and there's a less obvious reason to rebalance?
That's right. And it keeps people from doing the opposite of this. By rebalancing, it's kind of like having two kids, and they bring home their report cards from school, and one kid has an A, and you send her to a room, and the other kid has a D, and you take him out to Dairy Queen to reward him for that. But that's what you have to do in rebalancing. You take money out of things that have done well and put it into things that haven't done as well. And it keeps you from doing the opposite. Many investors, when they have complementary investments, they see one doing really well, and then they see one that hasn't done as well. They have the tendency to take it out of the thing that's done poorly and put more money into the thing that's done well, which is obvious. It's very natural to feel that way. But when you do that, you end up buying high and then selling low.
And you don't want to do that.
Do not want to do that.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Coming up, we will talk about the boom in 401k rollovers. We'll also shop around for some decent prices when it comes to airline tickets. And we are welcoming your questions about personal finances, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Here's an email from Mark. He says, I'm a short time and occasional listener. Thanks a lot, Mark. My wife and I are 26, and we are looking into saving for retirement with the understanding that the sooner we get started, the better off we'll be. I don't have a financial advisor, but I would like to start an IRA. My problem is I can't seem to find any with high interest rates. I always hear about. How do I find an IRA worth investing in?
Good for you, Mark. Just about any IRA is better than no IRA. But the IRA is really just a jar, and it's a jar in which you can deposit money, and then while that money is in that jar, pick from many different kinds of investments. And those can be as bland and mundane as CDs, or they can be as exciting as stocks and different kinds of bonds and more esoteric investments. And so the high interest rates, if the money is safe, it's not going to pay very much. CDs only pay anywhere from nothing to 2, maybe 3% right now on longer term CDs. And I think what maybe an error you're making is looking at the difference between interest rates and returns. And you're probably reading or hearing about people who invest in IRAs that are in the stock market in mutual funds, and they might have made 10% in the last 12 months. And that hopefully will continue, and I hope for your sake it does, but that also means that it can go down 20, 30, or 40% in a bad year as well, if it can go up that much in a year or two. So I think you can handle that kind of risk based on your age and your goals, because you have, sadly, Mark, 40 years to turning 66. And so taking a little bit of risk to get a greater long-term return is a good idea, but it does mean that you may lose some money along the way. It can go down in value. Now, I would probably have you go to a place like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or TD Ameritrade. Those places are designed to help people who don't have a financial advisor and have a little bit of money and want to start out. But if you want to research those different funds, a great place to go is Morningstar.com. You can see all different kinds of funds and then decide which one hopefully is right for you.
Thanks, Mark, and good luck. Hope you become a longtime listener before too long. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. He is managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And if you don't call in with your question, I'm going to ask Kevin a bunch of questions about my just retired husband and what we should do with his 401k and the ins and outs of an LLC. But I'm sure that you would rather call in with your question. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. A very rare open line during this edition of On Your Money here on the Ideas Network.
Money, money.
And money is on our mind during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Our number, if you have a question for Kevin, is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our first caller is Amy in Madison. Hello, Amy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is, I recently sold my house and got about $50,000 back for my security deposit, and then we made some during the sale. And we are going to be moving cross country and renting, so I don't need the money for a security deposit. But I want to use some of the money to pay off a couple thousand dollars in student loan and other debt, and I want to do it in a manner that's going to improve my credit and keep it strong. So I'm wondering if my best bet is to pay things off in lump sums or to just pay over time, and then kind of what to do with the remaining balance that I just want to kind of hold on to for a couple of years.
Good for you, Amy. Why are you moving cross-country? Are you on the lam or something, or what's going on?
No, my husband is going out to Oregon to get his PhD, so we are headed out there.
Okay. Are you going to be working outside the home once you get out there?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what I would recommend is that you pay them off in one lump sum, especially the larger interest. The student loans, you're probably paying, what, 6-7%, something like that on it?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay. That's why you called. I check on the interest rates. The things that are costing you a lot of money, credit cards or student loans, I would pay those off sooner the better. If you have things that are in the lower rate, sometimes people have car loans where they were got a premium rate of like 2% or 0% or whatever. I would be in no hurry to pay any of those kinds of loans off. And I would also keep that money set aside because is your husband going to be earning any money while he pursues his PhD?
Some, but we know we need it accessible just because we don't know what the next 4 years will look like.
Exactly. And so I would put that money, the rest of it, in a checking account. And you're not going to get paid anything for doing so, but you are going to have that money accessible to you over the next 4 years so that you don't have to take a job you don't want right away. You don't have to work in a place just for the money. You can take a job that feels better for you and fits better for your schedules. And I wouldn't have any problem whatsoever living off that money, in part, while you're doing this. It'd be nice to escape the 4 years with a PhD and some money in savings, but this is a big investment of your time and your life, and so make sure you use that money to kind of get through this the best you can, rather than just, you know, slogging yourself and flogging yourself to try to survive, but to preserve this, because hopefully once he's done, then you'll be back on the road again and looking for a house, and if there's money left at that time, you can use that as a down payment as well. But other than that, no, pay off the debt that's above, say, 5% interest, and then keep the rest safe in savings for emergencies, and maybe drop the bar down a little bit in terms of what defines an emergency for you. Not necessarily just when you need a kidney or something, but more when you just have a job you hate or doesn't fit in with your lifestyle.
And then, so for any credit cards that we have a balance on and we pay that off, we should still keep those cards open, even though hopefully our future involves no credit cards now that we've got a little bit of cushion money. But we should still keep those open, correct?
Correct. That's right. And part of that is just those are one more place to, if an emergency were to come up, I would rather have you put it on the credit card. Like, let's say you needed a car repair and it were several thousand dollars. I'd rather have you put that on the credit card, pay a little bit of interest, and preserve your savings for other bigger emergencies down the road. And then if you get it all the way through the 4 years and you still have that credit card debt, then go ahead and pay it off.
Awesome. Well, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck, Amy. Be sure to listen online at 6 o'clock in the morning from Portland. We'll miss you. Matt in Oconomowoc is with us next. Hello, Matt.
Good morning. My question is: my wife and I have a potential opportunity to move, and we're curious, in general, how much house can we afford based on our income?
What's your income?
Could be as high as 167 between the two of us a year.
Okay. Well, the good news is, Matt, for you, is that I'm not the final decision maker on how much house you can afford. That's a lender. But I will tell you that in terms of the lender's perspective, they're usually going to tell you that you can afford a mortgage payment, property taxes, and insurance that's no more than one-third usually of your gross monthly income. And when you say could be, it sounds like that your income is a little unpredictable.
Well, it would depend on my wife's new job.
Okay, good. You married well, that is what you're saying, right?
She didn't marry well.
Well, you're handling the details while she makes the money. It's a partnership. Somebody's got to do it all, so good for you. You're usually probably looking at a mortgage payment, I would guess, in the $3,000 to $4,000 range, and that can probably afford you way more house than you could possibly buy. I would rather have you not buy a house that cost any more than three times your gross income, and in your case, maybe two times is kind of the limit. So the $350 to $450 is probably where I top out, and that's assuming the job is fairly predictable and fairly secure, and there's a very good chance that your jobs are going to be there for you for the next 3 to 5 years.
And at your recommendation, that would allow us, in concept, I know there are details that you don't know and I don't know, but that would allow you conceptually the enough extra room then to max out or come close to maxing out a 401k, do some other savings and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I would do with that extra money, is max out your pre-tax retirement accounts after you've figured out how to get the best mortgage arrangement. And by the way, Matt, go with the 80-30 rule. Get a mortgage for at least 80% of the value of the house and get a 30-year mortgage and pay it down as slowly as you possibly can.
Happy house hunting, Matt. Thanks for the call. Steve in Wausau is with us now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. this time of year, you always get bombarded with these offers from the credit card companies, balance transfers, and then they have a transaction fee. And I've noticed that the transaction fees have gone from 1% to 2% to 3% to 4%, even 5% over the years now. And I'm wondering if is this going to translate into our savings accounts being paid more money in the future if they're making more money on
these
things?
Of course.
you would think, right? It only seems fair. No, it's actually part of the same problem. There are two things going on with the balance transfers. And for people who don't know this, some people who have debt, and I don't mind this at all, but it as long as you're on top of the game, they play kind of a musical chairs game with their credit cards, meaning they move it from one provider who offers a 0% interest for, say, 12 months, and then once the 12 months is up, they look for another provider that offers 0% or low interest or whatever. And the problem, of course, is that the provider is trying to catch people. They're trying to catch them violating the terms of the agreement. They're trying to catch them getting into trouble so they can't find a new place to go so that they can then start charging 12 or 18 or 29.99% interest on that balance in there. Now, that's not going to translate to higher interest rates for you, because the reason they're charging these fees is because they're not making enough money on their other things, like lending the money out or investing the money. And when they don't make money on lending it out and investing it, then they also can't pay a very high interest rate. A lot of people call me and are very disgusted with their credit union or the bank, and they say they're ripping me off. They're only paying me 1% interest on my credit or on my checking account. And I say, where is this place? Because I have people with millions and millions of dollars who would love to get 1% interest on their checking account. So the bank and the credit unions are not ripping you off. They're doing the best they can. They're trying to charge as much as they can and still make a profit and stay in business.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Steve, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And this is On Your Money. We welcome your personal finance question at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for Smart Assets. Retiring is a tough enough step to deal with, but it can also be made worse when you're trying to figure out what to do with your 401k. And Kevin, this is precisely the question I was going to ask you about my just retired husband's financial issues. So what about that?
All this work you've put in for these last 300 and some shows, and you're finally getting some information that's relevant to
right.
you. Yeah, there's some big money at stake here. There are about $6 trillion in 401k plans right now, and about $300 to $400 billion of that is rolled over every single year, generally from retiring workers. The average balance of six-figure earners who are over 60 is about $400,000, according to AON Hewitt, and they do a lot of servicing of probably about 8 to 10 million different 401k accounts. But there are lots of problems with people who are in this situation. And it's inviting that music of Get Smart is very appropriate, because a lot of government agents are looking into this practice and what's going on with people in this situation, the Department of Labor, Securities and Exchange Commission, FINRA, which is the self-regulating organization of the securities business, are all looking into what's going on with this.
Wow, this is intriguing. What kind of problems and scrutiny are we talking about?
Well, there are a few things, and one of the big reasons the SEC jumped into it is that it's a government agency, and they were getting notices to take money out from the TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan, which is a very inexpensive, very well-run retirement savings account for government employees. And the SEC employees were getting notices, hey, you got to move this money out, move it into something that we're doing from private investment advisors. Well, one of the things that they're finding is that the General Accounting Office did an undercover study where they pretended to be a worker with a retirement plan and said, I'm looking to retire and I'm going to move my money from where it's at right now to someplace else, or I might leave it in there. What should I do? And about a third of those people received wrong information, and the information was incentivized towards the people giving them. There's a concern that the providers of these 401ks, the private companies that do it, are giving bad information to employees who are thinking about leaving the company so that people will roll the money over to an IRA with the company, and therefore that the company will then make more money off of the IRA than they've been making by leaving it in the 401k. Now, that doesn't mean it's a bad idea to take it out of the 401k. You generally get more freedom and you get more control over it in terms of how you invest it and what you do with the money, but it also can be more expensive than keeping it in the 401k.
So then maybe it would be better to roll it over to a different company?
It can be, but not necessarily. They ran into a lot of the same issues, and a lot of people are preying on retirees, especially ones who are at larger companies, in the form of seminars and mailings. And they found that when these people were generally advising them to move it over, they weren't putting the money into things that they would normally want them to put the money into.
So what advice do you have for would-be retirees, or for that matter, just retirees?
For Rob?
Yes,
right.
For Rob, mm-hmm. Specifically. He's got an IRA. Does he keep it there? Does he roll it over? What should we think about when it comes to retirement plans?
Well, you probably don't have to roll the money out. Most people can actually keep it in their 401k if they want to. And you may be getting low-cost funds there, especially if you work for a much larger employer, one who has thousands of employees. Now, you might not get a ton of individualized help in that case, but there may be some help online available. And it's an especially good idea for people who are 55 to 59 and a half to think about leaving their money in the 401k, even if they are retiring, because if it's still in the 401k and they're over 55 but under 59 and a half, they can still pull the money out. They'll pay taxes on it, but they won't pay a 10% penalty on it. Whereas if they are going to move it over to an IRA and they're in that age bracket, they may pay a 10% penalty on it to pull the money out of the IRA in the future. Another thing to think about is if you may go back to work, and especially if you're going to go back to work for a larger company, you might want to leave the money in the 401k, because then you can move it to the future employer's 401k if you want as well.
Oh, all right. So what about those who still want to move it to a self-directed IRA?
You want to shop around, and if you can, try to find a fiduciary. A fiduciary is a person, a financial advisor, who is legally obligated to do what is best for you, even if it costs him or her money. Now, there are good financial advisors who aren't fiduciaries, and there are bad financial advisors who are fiduciaries, but that's still kind of a benchmark of what you want to look for in a financial advisor. You are free to ask how and how much that advisor gets paid for helping you, and if they don't give you a good answer or a satisfactory answer, lots of other advisors out there. Generally, it's better to pay a small ongoing fee than a large commission up front. And along those lines, stay away from annuities. Generally, annuities pay very high commission and give the seller a disincentive to give you the best advice. And they generally also cost you very huge amounts of money in the amount of fees that you pay for them. And for most people, the fees aren't worth the extra expenses. You may be able to do this yourself, and you may be able to do it with a little help from those companies we referred to early, like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or USAA. Many of them have lower cost assistance where they don't give you as much help, but they also don't charge you as much to give you that help as well.
Okay, well, that's helpful. That's a start. I'll talk to you more after the show about that.
Sure.
Let's take a call from Jenny in Oconomowoc. Hello, Jenny.
Oh, good morning.
Yes, good morning. What's your question for Kevin?
Kevin, I'm trying to understand a decision about an annuity that I have. Now, I always hear you say don't get annuities, but my husband and I each do have an annuity. And we just retired. We're both 67, and we both just started Social Security. And we sort of have an estimate on how much we think we're going to need per month, and we probably need about $1,000 more. And so I'm looking at making the annuity decision, and I can make it once a year. It's coming up in August. And so I looked at the options that I have, and I just don't understand how to make the decision, because the differences are so great between the 20-year certain and the life with 20-year certain, or if I want to build in growth like 1 or 2 or 3%, the range of what I could get per month is quite significant. And if I don't make the decision, I can make it again in a year, and it'll grow by 7%. So I just don't quite know how to make a decision when there's you know, like $175 a month difference between life with 20-year certain or 20-year certain, or even greater than that to get the growth built in. How do people decide?
They usually just call in a radio show. Millions and millions of people do. It's a very important decision.
Or just throw a dart.
They throw a dart. Jenny, and thank you very much for calling in, because you've illustrated one of the big issues that I have with these annuities. You have been either misled or explained in a way that wasn't particularly clear what was going on about this 7%. You were told that if you leave it in there, it grows 7% per year, correct?
Not the payment, but
right.
the base amount.
The base amount, mm-hmm. That comes with about 15 different asterisks and 7 different catches and 2 truckloads of salt, because people hear that 7% and they say, well, my money's growing at 7% per year in this annuity, and it's not. Most fixed rate annuities maybe pay 2% or 3% if they're good, and that doesn't make an annuity bad. It doesn't make your annuity bad, but it also means that it tends to kind of cloud the decision process, which it's obviously done here. But the income base maybe grows 7%, but the actual dollar amount doesn't grow. You won't, if you have $100,000 in there now, you won't have $107,000 just to pull out and do however you want at the end of next year. I would not annuitize that account. And annuitize means that you then take the payments for the terms that you discussed over your lifetimes, over a year period, whatever. I would just take out what you need out of that account. Is that an option for you?
You can take a certain percentage out. Yes, I can't
okay.
remember what it
Did
is.
You just take the annuity out, or have you had it a while?
No, I've had it 10 years.
Oh, great. First of all, don't let them roll you into a new annuity, because sometimes that happens because they're trying to get a new commission off of that particular pool of money. Unless there's a compelling reason, do not let them roll you over into an annuity, and you're probably past the surrender charge on that money. So my guess is you can take it all out and do whatever you want with it, or you can roll it over into another retirement account if it is set up already as a retirement account, or you can roll over into another annuity. If you take the money out, though, you pay taxes on all of it. But just take out the $1,000 a month or whatever you need out of it and use it as kind of a cookie jar to pull that out, and don't annuitize it. Because what you'll find if you look at the rates at which they give you for the annuitization, it's almost as good as just burying your money in the hole in the ground. They don't pay very much for it, and the reason being is they can't earn very much on your money guaranteed, so they can't give you much more than if you were to earn no interest at all.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to take it out. I'm going to pay taxes on it, which there was an exclusion of like 35% if I did annuitize it.
Sure.
Is that true if I take it out?
It's just a question. If you take it out now the way it is and just pull the money out piece by piece on a $1,000 basis, you'll pay taxes on that until you get to the principal, and then there's no taxes on that. Versus annuitizing it, they give you part of the tax break up front with each month's payment, but it lasts as long as you receive those payments. So you're going to pay taxes on it either more now and none later, or a little bit every single year. But I'd still rather have you pay a little bit more in taxes now and still have the flexibility with the account. Once you annuitize it, you're pretty much done with it. You can't get the lump sum. You can't make any changes with it whatsoever.
And then I just have to stay alive for 20 years.
That's a really good idea to do that.
Please do that.
All right. Wow. Well, that has been very informative. I really appreciate it.
I blew her freaking mind.
Mine too, Kevin. My goodness. I was mesmerized by that.
the drama.
Jenny, thank you for the call. That, I think, answer helped a lot of people. So, and we have more answers for you too with your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
The On Your Money Orchestra is in rare form again today with a wide variety of pieces they're working
That's
with.
That's right. And we are talking about your money, and I am especially interested in the next topic, our shop around topic. If you're thinking about a last-minute summer flight, The best time to book your flight is when, Kevin?
Right now. Absolutely today, because according to cheapair.com, they analyzed 1.3 billion airfares, and they said that if you are flying someplace, the best time to purchase the ticket is 54 days in advance of your departure. So with Labor Day just about that distance away, it's a good time to do it. They also found that the airfares generally bottom out at 54 days away, stay down for until 29 days away, and then start to rise. And 2 weeks away from your flight, you're crazy. You can end up paying 50 to 75% more in the week or two before you take off than you would if you were to buy it 2 months in advance of departure.
It's hard to keep all this straight. Why do we have to play these games to get a decent price for an airline flight?
Well, it's because so many people want to fly, and the prices are going up as well. They rose 6% in May alone, the most in 1 month in 15 years, in part because of the troubles in the Mideast and the Ukraine affecting oil prices and fuel prices. Peter Greenberg, the noted travel expert, put up a website where he said the best time to actually buy a flight is Wednesday at 1 a.m., right after midnight on Tuesday night, depending on that airline's location, because he said the way that they bounce cheap flights out and that the way that they determine if people actually purchase those tickets or not, and he put a listing up at petergreenberg.com. We'll put that up at onyourmoney.com. But he said that people can save a lot of money just by calling that particular airline at Tuesday at midnight to Wednesday at 1 a.m. and get a much better deal. But he said you have to call them. You can't go online. The reason that they're also charging more and playing all these different games is in part because of the fuel prices, in part because of the demand. The average price now is up to about $400 per flight and close to $1,000 on average for an international flight or whatever. But it's because the airlines are getting so good at managing their inventory and figuring out how to maximize the revenue. It's a very interesting business because they can't just print more seats. They have to have the limited number of seats, and if people aren't on them, they find that they end up with an empty seat. And there's a correlation effect here. When airline tickets rise 1%, the volume declines 1% in general because people become less likely to fly. For every 1% rise, there's a 1% drop in the number of people trying to buy tickets. The other factors, of course, are many fees are coming into place. There is a new fee coming in that is put in by the government shutdown. It stems from back in October. They said, hey, we're going to start charging these flyers an extra fee that could end up being $20 to $30 for a round-trip ticket, depending on how many legs you have. That's ostensibly going to fund the Transportation Security Administration, but that's also going on, and that could be another 5 to 10% increase as well. And then even when you find a flight that works for your schedule and it's at a fairly good price, you're still not done figuring out if it's a good deal or not.
Well, why not?
you have to consider the fees, the luggage fees, how many bags you're bringing on, if you're going to put it in the overhead compartment, stuff it in there. And there was a recent listing of fees that airlines have either implemented already or are considering. One is an air purification system. One airline said we're going to start charging flyers $5 a ticket because we put a new air purification system in the plane. Another one is charging for plastic bags for security. You know, you have to pop all your stuff in the plastic bags going through. One airline designated a smoking area so that flyers, before they got on board, could have a cigarette before they went on, but they're going to start charging them to use that. Another airline is considering charging people for drop-off zones. They're considering charging for blankets. Ryanair actually did this. I think it was like $160 or something. They will charge you if you don't notice that your name is misspelled when you purchase the ticket right away within 24 hours of the purchase, and then you get there and say, well, I can't keep going because the name on my ticket doesn't match my driver's license. They will charge you $160 to change that. And Ryanair is also a couple years ago considered doing this. I would not be blown away if they did it in the future, but start charging people to use the restroom on the plane.
Oh my gosh. Well, are there any other tools, any other resources that we can use to try to get the very best possible deal on an airline ticket?
Yeah, some of the older ones like Travelocity and Priceline have improved a lot. Kayak is still the best one out there at kayak.com. They also have a nice website that delineates all of the fees that you may charge for every single airline. But there's a new kid on the block, a little family-owned company out in California by the name of Google. And they have a google.com/flights, which is one of the most elegant, fastest way to not only see what the cheapest way is to fly, but also the projected price rise and fall of the ticket over the coming weeks and months. And we'll put links up to those websites at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Well, I know what I'm going to do at when I get up for work at 1 o'clock in the morning. I can make a few calls to some airlines.
No, this could be a side business for you, where you just people take their list and you're up anyway, so why not book 10, 20 tickets and take a small fee out of it?
Yeah, well, I will mention that I complained on Facebook about a trip I was trying to take on Frontier frequent flyer miles, and Frontier was not flying to the destination where I was going, so I couldn't use those. And someone let me know that Southwest has a cheap a sale going on right now where possibly $89 one way, which sounds pretty good. Sometimes when there are airline sales like that, don't others try to follow suit to at least
to
get
compete
some of the business?
Right, and a good way to do that, you mentioned Facebook, a friend and Twitter and whatever else, get your GeoCities page for all these other airlines, because those are typically the ways that they release those results. And sometimes if it's a very good fare and they're limited number, that's they're gone before everybody else hears about it.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And now, room for you and your phone call, your question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Karen in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Karen.
Good morning. Good morning. My 25-year-old son asked me a question, and I didn't have the answer, but I knew the wise and wonderful Kevin would.
Is it about what is it? Sex education?
No,
or what? No, no. Okay, because this is a later age, from what I understand.
He's asking about and putting his money in a Roth IRA as opposed to a savings account.
Mm.
I know he started a Roth IRA last week. Didn't put in the maximum, but he put some money in it. And he was asking me, why should I have a savings account at all? Why shouldn't I just put all my money in the Roth, since that interest is not taxable? I thought he'd ask you that.
It's not a bad idea. The only problem comes in twofold. One is if he needs the money and he has to pull it out, it's tougher to get it out of a Roth IRA than it is a savings account. And the other one is, depending on the investments, he should be investing in higher risk, therefore higher potential return investments, and a savings account should be just that, for savings. And he's not going to make anything on it, but it will be there if and when he needs it. The Roth IRA, I'd recommend maybe a target date mutual fund. That's one that is geared towards retiring 40 years from now. So he could pick the 2055 fund from a company like Vanguard, and it would start out very aggressive and become more conservative as time goes on. But the reason he wants to leave it in there, Karen, is just because he might need it for something. And if he's invested it appropriately in the Roth IRA, there's a very good chance it could be worth 30 or 40% less than what he originally put it in there. That doesn't make it bad. It just means that there's a lot of volatility to the potential returns.
Okay, so he should find a targeted date mutual fund as opposed to putting his money in a Roth IRA?
Well, the target date fund can actually be purchased within the Roth IRA. He should also have some savings set aside for those emergencies that have nothing to do with the Roth IRA.
Yeah, so a savings account is still a good idea.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. All right, Karen?
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Kevin in Mabel, Minnesota. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question stems, I'll give you kind of a background as far as where we're at financially. My wife and I, we both own a home. We have a 5-year-old son. My wife is in a state retirement fund, as she is a state employee. I also have assets set aside in a state retirement fund. And we also have Roth IRAs built on top of those, on top of my 401k that I currently contribute to. My question for you is, with my 5-year-old son, when he turns 18 or before he turns 18 for a college education fund to build up, could we move any of those funds from those retirement accounts into a trust fund for him and his education tax-free, or is that something that we would have to pay tax on up front?
Are they actual IRAs or are they your, like, employer plans?
They're actually my IRAs.
Okay, you can pull some money out of IRAs. not tax-free, but penalty-free to pay for higher education expenses. You can also pull the contributions out of Roth IRAs whenever you want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever for any reason at any time, and that can also be used for college. But I don't recommend that you do that unless you absolutely have to. So are you saying that you're worried you won't have enough money for college, or are you saying this is some kind of strategy you want to employ?
I thought that it would have been some sort of a strategy that I might want to put. I know that, you know, with him being five, he's got a ways before he turns 18, so I know that there's plenty of time there that I could build up a fund for him.
Right.
But I thought that there may have been a strategy involved in doing that, and that was a question that I had for you this morning to see if that may be worth doing.
It's not worth doing moving one from the other. If you can save some money for him, you can do it in something like a 529 college savings plan. And you can go to savingforcollege.com or collegesavings.org to research those.
Kevin, thanks you, Kevin, for your call. Sue emails, I love your program. My husband is a state employee who hopes to retire in the next few years. He wants to work as much extra as possible to build up his highest three earning years. Would increasing his income of, say, $10,000 a year make a big difference in what he will be able to collect at retirement?
Sue knows how to get her question answered on this show. that it will make some difference, not as much as you might think, and not nearly as much as the extra $10,000 a year in earnings will make on what you can spend in retirement. But more is definitely better. And I like how Sue is vicariously putting her husband into working more rather than the husband saying, I want to work more as well. He wants to work more. He wants to make more money. No, that's a good idea just to make the extra money anyway. It won't have a dramatic effect on the retirement pension, but it will have a nice effect on your net worth. It's probably about a $2 for one, I'm guessing, in terms of how much more money in retirement he might be able to save.
Yeah, you know, we have just a moment, a minute or so to go, but somebody with a follow-up to our email bag wondering, and you did touch on this, so maybe we just clarify, is there an advantage to rebalancing a 401k account when the market is up or down?
Mm-hmm. The advantage is that it keeps you on track and keeps you from doing something stupid.
There we go. All right, time for the website of the week.
If you want to research financial advisors and also the fees and mutual fund offerings of your employer's plan, if you work for a larger employer, go to brightscope.com. Brightscope.com has listings of different financial advisors by area or expertise, and then it also can break down all the different funds in a larger employer, tell you if it's a good plan, good funds, and what the expenses are in those accounts. And again, we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
All right, and we have time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He is with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. We are live on Tuesday mornings, rebroadcast on Tuesday evenings, and then rebroadcast again on Sunday mornings. If you have a question for Kevin that we might use for a future On Your Money email bag, you can email that to onyourmoney@wpr.org. onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.